This is K. Scott Allen of OJCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com. Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded somewhat live on March 16th, 2001. We're talking tonight with Eric Ridgway and Chris Bilson and Bobby Johnson. They recently participated in a hackathon for a nonprofit group called Harmony Hill. The goal of this was a 48-hour 48-hour hackathon was to get as many devs together as they could and try to write some open source software that the charity needed, that the center needed. I believe it was some scheduling software, and there's one other kind. Well, we can talk about it as we go on here. So we're going to go in alphabetic order by first name, because that way Eric is last. So Bobby, you want to introduce yourself and kind of give some background?
Sure. My name is Bobby Johnson. I'm a senior application developer for Russell Investments in downtown Seattle. My Twitter handle is not myself, and my blog is imnotmyself.com, and I'm a gratuitous self-promoter. I guess that's all.
That goes without saying with this group.
My name is Chris Bilson. I used to work with Bobby and Eric at Russell, but now I work somewhere else, and I'm a developer too, obviously, and that's about it.
I'm Eric Ridgway. Twitter handle is angelfire with threes because I'm all elite, and my blog is angelfire.wordpress.com. I work with Bobby as a senior application developer at Russell Investments, and my wife is not only the product owner of the project we worked on, but also works at Harmony Hill.
And we should also mention that all three of you are very active in the local Seattle, let's call it alt.net chapter, which is, I don't know if it's the longest going one, that's probably the Austin one, but I've been very proud of it, even though I never get to go because weekends pretty much belong to my two girls. But the fact that they've been meeting regularly ever since the first really large alt.net gathering up here, at least once a month, and they haven't limited themselves to just talking about tools or things like that. It's been a really positive experience, despite what you might hear about alt.net around the rest of the country or world or something. So Eric, you were the one that kind of started this whole thing and got the idea. What first gave you the crazy idea to get 12 devs together in a room with one Wi-Fi access point and try to code?
That kind of all started while pairing with Chris and working on a project. And I had gotten the idea kind of from the idea of GiveCamps. And I liked it a lot, and my wife working for the charity had kind of told us, you know, they had all these problems trying to do some of their business processes. And being experienced with them, I helped set up a lot of their equipment, got them kind of onto SBS from their peer-to-peer network and stuff, had done all that stuff for them. So I kind of understood their pain and the environment. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be kind of cool if we could find a way for us to do sort of a give camp thing and talk to her. And she talked to the organization, and they thought it was a really great idea to maybe kind of have us come up there and see what could happen. And they're a retreat center, so they have beds and places for people to sleep, and they prepare food and have all of that available. So basically what happened is they were for it. Everybody else was for it. I talked to Bobby and a bunch of the other members of alt.net and all the people we worked with, and kind of everybody was pretty jazzed about the idea. Like, yeah, it's an awesome reason for a bunch of friends to get together, meet new friends, hang out with people, and write software for a better reason than making money. And so we kind of figured out what projects needed to be there and decided we'd let it just kind of be organic. And showed up on a Friday about 5, 6 o'clock, and hacked basically nonstop until the mid-afternoon that next following Sunday, or that Sunday, and hacked as hard as we could, and had a really kind of interesting time doing that. And my wife, of course, was playing the role of a product owner, so we were trying to be as agile as we could about everything. I kind of put all the practices that we talk a lot about and work a lot within our organization kind of together in one space and see if we could do it in a really short period of time and see what could happen. Part of the goal, too, is to, of course, make everything open source. If we're working for a nonprofit, why not put everything out there and let other nonprofits use it if they find themselves in need of similar software?
So how did you coordinate things? Was, I mean, set up a, I mean, were you working off like GitHub? Were you, how were you coordinating? Like, I mean, did you have things, you know, like Kanban? I mean, you know what I mean? What's the kind of logistics of how things were run?
Yeah, actually we got to, get a lot of, support from Agile Zen. They were really cool about giving us a VIP account. So props to Agile Zen. That was awesome. And we kind of got everybody hooked up with that. The code is hosted up on GitHub. You can find it at github.com/harmonyhacks. And there's two repos in there, but the one you're interested in looking at is Dahlia. And that's the project we're actually working on. And everybody, you know, all users of Git or those who weren't necessarily users of Git learned quickly. And we tried to coordinate everything as much as we could. And to get everybody involved, you know, we used the list, we used Twitter, we used Eventbrite to set up the event. If you look on Eventbrite under harmonyhacks.eventbrite.com, you'll actually be able to see the list of all the people who showed up and kind of a description of the event itself.
And Bobby, at one point you used a GitHub visualization tool to visualize what the circle pull kind of looked like, and I remember retweeting it when you posted it on Twitter. It was really interesting to see, you know, Eric create the project. I think Eric or Bobby created the project first on GitHub, and then and just to see everyone kind of orbiting around it and pulls going back and forth requests. So how did that work in practice? Because a lot of people, you know, they talk about using GitHub and Git and Mercurial as a distributed versioning system. And, you know, I think they're working under the assumption that these pulls and requests will be, let's say, in a more time-diluted manner. So, but at one point, it seemed like you guys were saying that you were basically just, you know, pulling constantly. there wasn't a lot of time to code because you were just always pulling and getting the latest and merging.
Yeah, it was definitely a form of organized chaos, I guess. You basically had 12 kind of alpha geeks all trying to cram a full software project into the span of 48 hours. And it went a little nutty in the beginning, and especially when you try to start a project with 12 devs all in the code, right? We can't all work in one area at a time. And so we were stomping on each other quite a bit early on. And in the visualization that you're talking about, just Google the inception of circle pulling and it should take you to a Vimeo video. You can kind of see that where the GitK visualization shows all these crazy branching and merging, and it goes really haywire. But then by the end of the project, it kind of smooths out to a single trunk where we kind of caught a rhythm and had pairs of developers all kind of working in different areas of the system. And it's a real shame that we didn't just have one more day, because by the time Sunday rolled around, we hit a rhythm and we were moving really well. It was amazing to watch this team of 12 people kind of come together and cram a whole project into 48 hours. You had all the drama, all the stress, and then all the victories, you know. It was a lot of fun.
I think next time we have a hackathon on day one, we need to take away half of the computers. Because I think one of our problems that first night was that everybody was on their own computer hacking away and committing, and that's what kind of caused the circle pull thing to happen. But then by the next day and by Sunday, we were pairing, and you know, there was more communicating, more talking, and less, you know, random hacking.
Also, Eric Lee brought a monitor and a keyboard, and we kind of set that up in the middle, and that worked out really cool for us to kind of have one real pairing station people could work at. And I think if we had more of those available, like as a pre-planning kind of thing, I think we would have been a lot more effective as well.
I was going to say, I wonder if you went kind of with the benevolent dictator kind of model, where similar to Linux, where everyone else could check in these commits, but if you had one person who was kind of monitoring and accepting the pull requests and kind of coordinating everything in the beginning, at least until you get, you know, kind of assigned slices set up, I wonder if that would work a little better too.
Yeah, I kind of thought if we maybe had our stack kind of squared away before we started, and maybe had a couple stories too, because we were trying to gather stories from Vic while we're actively working on the app, trying to set certain things up, you know, kind of going with the Ruby on Rails model. If we could have just, you know, Rails new app and already had a data access strategy and migration strategies and all this stuff kind of baked in, we could have hit the ground running a little faster, but we did do a lot of cycle spinning early on, just kind of moving things around. And do we want to use structure map or do we want to use castle or that sort of thing?
I was going to say it's probably a minor miracle that that you were able to select an IOC container. And I guess all of you are pretty big fans of in Hibernate. So I guess that wasn't a big question whether you're going to pick in Hibernate or Link to SQL or simple.data or anything like that. But just the fact that you're able to pick an IOC container was probably a miracle.
I think it really came down to who got it in first. And Eric Lee is a big fan of structure map, and he got it in first. And I paired with him on getting it wired up into MVC, and so that became the container.
I also think it was an opportunity for us that haven't used it to learn something new. And it was a small kind of new thing to play with without necessarily going crazy, because that we wanted to learn some new stuff, but not kind of go crazy on the whole idea.
Most of us, I'd say most of us hadn't, well, there were a couple of camps, but a lot of us hadn't worked together before. And that was another big, I don't want to say time sink, but something that took up a lot of time, but was also kind of a growth experience, I guess, was working with other developers, actually developing code instead of just sitting around talking about stuff and seeing how other people did things, other teams, how they worked together and things like that. It was really nice.
So have we gone through enough of a rundown? I'm looking just in at Dahlia Lib and taking a look at all the page down at all the different libraries and things that are pulled in. I mean, do you want to run through some of the high ones? I mean, as far as so we're talking about structure map. I'm seeing nHibernate, RhinoMox. I mean, for testing.
So maybe that is the other question is how did you come to decide on ASP.NET MVC, or did you? Versus Rails versus Django versus anything else that you had? Is it just familiarity, or was there any particular reason that you picked some of the libraries that you did and some of the other frameworks that you did?
Least common denominator.
Yeah, I think that's really what it came down to is we actually wanted to deliver software in 48 hours, not just kind of a navel gaze on what would be cool to use, because, it is for a charity and we did want to deliver software that they could actually use at the end of the event. So we kind of went with what we knew. And you mentioned scrolling through the lib folder and everything being, quite a bit of stuff there. That's kind of a byproduct of NuGet. NuGet, you say install in Hibernate and it has a dependency on Antler and it has a dependency on Castle Core. And it kind of gets all those libs in there together and, as separate packages instead of kind of bundling them together. That's why it looks so kind of big and disorganized. But really, it kind of just comes down to Fluent in Hibernate, Fluent Migrator, MVC, and some testing tools.
And we also were dependent on the fact that this is actually deployed internal. They have a Windows-based server that was already available to them, so it was really easy to just deploy, install it, IIS, get everything running, and run on their internal environment instead of being something external like being on Heroku or something like that. So that was a pretty easy, pretty fast choice for us.
And then this is using machine specifications for specifications?
It's using machine spec pretty much. I think that's kind of a consistent thing, at least for I know myself, Bobby, and I got it from Chris. So we're all at least familiar with it and writing specs that way. And we all know how to wire it up on TeamCity, and we build with Saki. So there's a TeamCity server actually running internal to actually do all the CI builds and was actually doing kind of an auto deploy. Just with a basic copy and paste on its own, because they're on the same as the deployment server.
And that definitely seems like having a CI server is a huge part of getting a bunch of people to be productive in a short amount of time. I mean, I found in teams where you've got that set up early in the project, things are moving a lot more quickly. I mean, I guess that sounds pretty obvious, but...
Yeah, it helped a lot.
I was going to say that that's actually how we were able to kind of start to divide and conquer on the application. One of the other participants, Justin Bozenier, really kind of took the lead with developing stories and trying to draw out exactly what the problem space was that we're working on from our product owner. And Eric Lee and I kind of paired up on getting kind of infrastructure plugged in. So I already mentioned we worked on getting structure map wired in. Then we worked on the Zocchi build and getting it running in TeamCity and getting it executing all of our specs and unit tests. And you were asking about that. Yeah, we've got MSpec in there, but we've also got NUnit kind of, so for high level specifications and then kind of low level testing using NUnit.
And that's something I've been hearing more lately is, you know, the combination of the high and low level, like the BDD style, and then, you know, the unit testing using NUnit, XUnit, whatever, for, you know, code blocks.
Yeah, it feels kind of silly, you know, writing a huge specification class to do some tests on date time parsing, you know.
Right.
Let's see. I forgot what I was going to ask.
You're probably going to ask if they're using it or not. So
I was going to say that is the $100,000 question, or at least the $299 dollar store question. How much did you actually get done in 48 hours?
We're actually really close in getting it done. And people are actually actively working. It was really cool to see the community, the people who showed up, really get excited and continue to work after the retreat was over. And we've done a couple like lunch and hacks and stuff like that at work, and people are still kind of interested. And as a matter of fact, Alt.NET Seattle, in the open source portion of Alt.NET Seattle, will actually have a session for hacking on Dahlia. I talked to Justin earlier yesterday kind of about that idea. He called me and wanted to suggest it, and I thought, yeah, that'd be awesome. And so we're going to hook it up. And people can come and kind of hack on Dahlia and really contribute to this organization and to the world in general and do something pretty cool. But no, they're not actually using it yet today. They're really, really close. And my wife keeps harping on me to help get it fixed.
And she's not impressed enough just seeing the circle pull visualization. I mean, I think that's, you know, I'd call it done.
Actually, she's pretty impressed. She's actually showed it to a lot of people. Matter of fact, she's here right now. So if you kind of want to get her perspective on what happened, we can kind of just kind of, you know, ask her a couple of questions and find out how she feels about it, being the product owner, being there on site the whole time and seeing how things went. So if you guys got a minute, I'll hand her the headset and she can tell you the story.
While we're waiting,
we need Jeopardy music.
Do, 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 do.
So one of the cool things that I can point out while we're waiting for Vic is this was kind of the first project where we really heavily used Chewy, which is the kind of bundler for .NET written in PowerShell that Eric has been working on. That's available up on GitHub as well. So just search for Chewy, and that worked out really well. It was pretty nice to be able to just add a package reference to a text file and have Chewy manage updating that for you and pulling all of the packages you depend on at once.
Can you describe that a little more just for people that aren't familiar with Bundler? So the idea is you're pulling a bundle of packages all at once. That's
sure. Well, Bundler in Ruby on Rails, or not Rails, but Ruby, is kind of a package management system where you have one point or one file in your project where you describe the other packages you'd like to use. Like maybe you want to use Factory Girl or SQLite or something like that. And so you list out all of your dependencies in one file, and then Bundler manages pulling those updates for you. And I'll let Eric explain what Chewy does.
Well, first we'll ask Vic a little bit about her perspective on how things were going, and did it seem like it was just disorganized chaos, or was it somewhat organized, or how long did it take before they had a really good feel for what was going on?
Well, first of all, I had to survive interrogation by Justin, who took on the task of kind of architecting what was going to happen and creating the stories and things of that nature. And certainly I had never experienced that before, so that was unique. However, I actually found the whole process fascinating, getting to just be in a position of sitting back and kind of making sure that all the guide's needs were met. I was in awe. It was like so fabulous to be in that room with that much brain power. It was just fantastic.
So what kind of perspective did you have on kind of the software development process before, I mean, so you're married to a programmer, so you know, you get bored with all the stories from coming home and talking about the excitement of using a Lambda or the unmitigated gall of somebody to not use generics. I'm sure that is thrilling pillow talk. But did seeing this kind of happen real time live kind of change your perspective on how hard or how easy it is to build software?
Well, Eric and I actually spend quite a bit of time talking about his work, and I listen. And fortunately, in all of that, I had learned enough of the vocabulary to be able to keep up with most of what was going on. And he had also spent some time kind of schooling me on what the expectations of a good product owner should be, not to be too married to this is how we do it, or this is how it has to be, or it should look like this, and really just create an open space of just allowing the guys to throw out their ideas and be able to explore them and be very open-minded to, okay, well, I'm not going to get this functionality now, but maybe I'll get this functionality in the future. And I only tried to only ask once of, will it be able to do that in the future though? And so everyone was like, yes, yes, don't worry. And I was like, awesome. And so getting to go through that process and just watching Agile in action, it was just this incredible flow of, you know, the guys working together and being able to push through their various sections and just watching this teamwork. And it was somewhat mysterious to me in the sense that, you know, I know they're doing all of this stuff and I'm not entirely cognizant of all of it, but it was just a fascinating process. And getting to one of the unique things that they did was, as the product owner, they decided the product owner should be the tester. And so I had to sit down and be the one to like click through things as it was being developed, and they all thought that was brilliant, and it, you know, worked really well, and that was very understandable to me, and they all appreciated that perspective of, huh, all product owners should be the ones that test drive it for the display of it when they're putting it together and after they've compiled everything. And it was actually pretty cool.
Yeah, that was actually one of the cooler things about the whole process, was actually sitting Vic in front of a machine and saying, here's your app, click on it, use it. And also, I think by the end, we were having stand-ups every half hour. So we'd stand up, go around the room. What are you working on? What are your blockers? What can we do to help? And then doing another half-hour sprint. And that was a pretty cool process to see kind of compressed that way. At Russell, with my teams, we usually try to shoot for two-week sprints. But, you know, compressing it down to half-hour sprints really got you super focused, almost like a Pomodoro kind of thing, you know?
What was interesting when I worked with Dave Foley was he said that shortening your sprints won't help you solve your business process problems, but it will shine a huge spotlight on them. So going from 2 weeks to a week to a half week, I can't imagine what a 30-minute sprint cycle would be like. You know, there would be hangings, I guess, every hour and a half.
Yeah, it definitely shone a spotlight. Like you say, we kept reworking within Hibernate and the mappings and that sort of thing. So it was really, you know, apparent when I stood up every half hour and say, yeah, it can't save to the database. You know, so everybody's kind of looking at you curmudgeonly, like, what are you doing, sort of thing. So, yeah.
It sounds like extreme programming.
By the end of the day, yeah, definitely it was.
So you did stand-ups every half hour, every hour, every 2 hours, or every 10 minutes, or?
Well, it kind of shrank as we ran out of time, right? So the Friday night, we all just kind of hacked willy-nilly and did whatever. And Saturday, we tried to get it down to two-hour sprints. And by Sunday, you know, there was a smaller group of people left, and we dropped it down to half an hour, trying to stay laser-focused on getting the functionality done before we left.
We did find, though, that as we got to that point, sometimes we felt that maybe we were spending too much time in the stand-ups. So we tried to even shorten and tighten those. Like, people were just kind of blurting out really fast what they were doing, what they were done with, so that we could get back to actually doing work. Like, 15-minute stand-ups were down to maybe 5 minutes at the most.
So earlier, Bobby had mentioned that you guys use Chewy, which is kind of a bundler, and we talked a little bit about bundlers. I wonder if you could describe a little bit more how you set up Chewy and why you used PowerShell and kind of some of those things, and why it's important to have a bundler. I mean, we kind of get it that, you know, yeah, it'll pull these things automatically, but how often do you have to really pull these dependencies? Don't you just, you know, pull them once and leave them, or do you need to update every hour? And does it work on a build server? you guys used TeamCity for continuous integration. Were you able to have it, you know, if you added a new, there's a lot of questions in this, so I hope y'all are taking notes. No. If you were able to add a new dependency to the Chewy file and, you know, check it in and push it up to TeamCity, was it able to then go and run a pull for NuGet, grab that dependency and then build, or had you gotten that far with it at the time? Because I know it's kind of a new project, but
At the time, Chewy was pretty young, but I spent some time kind of looking at Bundler because you know, Bobby had kind of had this idea that we should build something like that real quick while we were kind of playing with NuGet. Like literally, as soon as it kind of became as soon as the console version dropped, we really got interested in it. And so while they were building a bunch of NuGet packages, because we're actually starting to kind of move towards using that internally, I ran off because I was doing something else, but kind of real quick slapped together a PowerShell script that could just at least automate the command line of reading through a file, pulling down some names, and installing those packages. And then I did a little bit more research on Bundler to kind of see how it works and what its features were and things like that to kind of see what was available. And it's all written in PowerShell, mostly A, because it's really easy to use the module or just the script from Saki. So you can just kind of call the modules when they're loaded and have it actually read out of the NuGet file. It has most of the features of Bundler, except probably the one that makes Bundler, the gem Bundler for Ruby, really special. That Bundler actually keeps a version of all the files in that lock file, actually keeps exactly the ones that were working. Chewy doesn't actually do that. But it does allow you to have a nice, clean way of keeping a list of all those dependencies, their versions, and their sources all available. Even before, actually, the console could put it in a special directory, Chewy could do that. But it's basically just a way for you to list all your dependencies in one place, see them all in a file, be able to push that up to a CI server, have it reach out to either your internal NuGet feed or the general NuGet feed, and pull down those dependencies. As a matter of fact, it actually has the ability to get some of them from the general feed and some of them from your private feed, so you can have your own private NuGet packages within your organization and still pull the open source ones like in Hibernate. But if you have something special for your org, you can pull that off your own private NuGet feed internally and kind of mix and match all that stuff together. But for the most part, it's really about making your life simple with using the command line version of NuGet. And then we've had some additions from the community to actually have it run in the PowerShell console inside of Visual Studio, the package manager console. And so it's actually available inside there as well as being just straight from the command line. But mostly we built it because we wanted to use it, and worked out really well.
That's definitely something I want to get to when internally at Russell, we kind of went through this last year of having serious dependency hell across multiple projects. You know, we don't really work on one giant monolithic system. We tend to work very closely with a product owner and a small team that needs some highly specialized financial software. So we end up writing like lots of little applications. And so over the course of, you know, a year, these applications kind of start to get out of sync where, you know, the one you did at the beginning of the year is maybe using in Hibernate 2.4, but by the end of the year, you're using 3.1. So the internal NuGet server that Eric is talking about, I really see us moving towards no longer putting our dependencies into source control, but scripting that out in our Saki builds to actually pull the assemblies from the internal NuGet server at build time.
So you guys are like a buzzword factory here. Can you talk a little bit about what Saki is and kind of describe it?
Sure. Saki is basically make in PowerShell. So it's the PowerShell version of Rake and that stuff. But I'll let Bilson talk more about it because he actually knows more about it. But I did want to mention that I actually been thinking about using John's NuGet downloader to actually download all the packages that we need to our internal feed. So there's a plug for John. Perfect, great tool for exactly what we need and kind of want to mix it together with pulling stuff down and making things ready for Chewy and just making this whole part of our lives super simple and so we can get back to building cool software.
So Saki's a like Eric said, it's like make written in PowerShell. So it's probably more inspired by Rake because Rake is a DSL written in Ruby. If you've ever used make before, the make build tool that like in the old days we used to build our C programs, it's not it's not in the same language you use to write other programs. It's in this special, you know, language, and it has its own weird quirks. Where the nice thing about Rake and Saki is that they're written in the same language that the programmer's using. So they're written in Ruby, or in Saki's case, it's written in PowerShell. So, you know, as long as you know PowerShell, you don't have to learn yet another weird language to do things like doing builds. And the thing I like about when I was at Russell, when we first started looking at using Saki to do builds, we'd been using Nant and MS Build and all the XML build programming languages. And the thing I really liked about Saki was that if I wanted to say something like svn.exe checkout, you know, some URL in PowerShell, that's exactly what I would say. I wouldn't have to say, you know, shell and then weird quoting rules to get it to have the right quoted command line arguments to the program that I was trying to run. In PowerShell, it was literally just, you just type in the name. It's like a batch file. You type in the name of the command that you want to run, and it just runs. So Saki is just a PowerShell DSL for doing builds. And it's on GitHub. James Kovacs made it. So I guess we can maybe put a link in the show notes or something like that if people need to find it. But if you Google Saki and it's P-S-A-K-E, you should be able to find it. It's a pretty Googleable name.
What other interesting kind of aspects came out of this? There's kind of this, well, this is not kind of, but there's this idea of emerging properties. So as you start to speed things up and get more chaos in, you'll start to see certain patterns emerge. Did you see any kind of working patterns? Did some people work together better than the other people? Or were some people just not able to get on the pairing bandwagon? Or were they able to adapt? Or did some people did they work better kind of off on their own and coming back in?
We definitely had all of that happening. You know, there was a really amazing developer there named Jeff Olson, who's really into some really cool JavaScript stuff like Backbone and Node.js and that sort of thing. And he was really into wanting to do the UI with this kind of technology that none of us was very familiar with other than Jeff. And so we kind of went down that trail for a while, and we realized we were kind of getting bogged down with the technology and not, you know, focused on delivering a product. And so, you know, we quickly kind of had to man up and say, you know, we've got enough technology. Let's just kind of brute force it and stick with some jQuery and, you know, hand roll in some UI stuff. And we kind of, even though the Node.js and Backbone stuff was cool, we just, you know, decided that we can't go down that road because it's bogging us down too much.
So what are the future plans for this project? It's open source. It's on GitHub. Anyone can fork and make a pull request and contribute more. Do you still have the stories up anywhere? Are they publicly available? You got any plans to make them available so that our both of our listeners who aren't our moms can start working on this project?
The stories aren't publicly available. They're in Agile Zen, but I would like to get them kind of maybe in a wiki or something and get them kind of out there. Maybe use the wiki inside of GitHub or the issues to actually put everything up there and get it available for people to start using. But there are a couple of things there. Anybody can pull it, make a fix, make a request. There's tons of people who can merge your requests in. But the kind of the future is to continue working on this and use it as an example for maybe doing more of this in the future. I don't see this as being necessarily the only project that comes out of this group or this idea. And myself, I'd like to kind of meld it into some continuous idea, maybe have it become kind of a annual or biannual thing. Have the guys kind of get together and do something that's like our jobs, but for a better reason, that's kind of out there and fun, you know, come together, hang out with a bunch of guys, drink beer, write some software and make the world a better place. And then hopefully that kind of spreads and maybe other people can start doing it. And we certainly learned a lot that we can teach other people.
So you had mentioned that at the upcoming Alt.NET Seattle 2011 Cirque de Extravaganza, we're gonna actually be doing things instead of just talking about software. How is that going to work? Do you think that, you just mentioned that you've got a lot to teach people. Do you think you're going to bring a lot of these lessons forward why would you do anything at an alt.NET conference? Why would you want to contribute? I mean, we're just supposed to be elitist and condescending, right?
why so mean?
You know, oh. I have to say, I went to the Alt.NET Seattle last year, or whatever it was called, the Alt.NET.
The February thing we
exactly.
had, I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I was, I don't know, I was expecting something different. I was expecting grumbling, and I don't know, just from what I picked up on the blogosphere that I was thinking it was going to be, you know, a circle of meanness. And it was just so much fun and friendly and cool, and, you know, it was just sharing a lot of, like, cool different technologies, and I don't know, after leaving there, this doesn't surprise me at all to hear that you guys went and did this open source, help people out kind of thing. I mean, and I think also the kind of, like, wide focus that you guys have on, you know, just keeping, like, the whole idea I thought when I first heard about Alt.NET was being in touch with, you know, what's out there. If it's Microsoft, like you guys use ASP.NET MVC and you like it, that's cool. If it's not Microsoft, but it helps you write great software, that's cool. And, you know, like, so I think this just, like, seems very natural for the vibe that you guys have, where it's like you're leveraging great software tools and doing good things with them.
Yeah, the Seattle Alt.NET crew's always kind of been that way. Since the first meeting, it's always been kind of a group of like-minded individuals kind of focused on sharing and learning. And it's always been kind of friendly. You know, there's a usual cast of characters who are there pretty regularly and some who show up infrequently. But it's always been kind of a fun group. And I think, you know, Alt.NET got kind of tarred early on. With the negativity thing, and I think a lot of that came out of, I don't know, exchanging exuberance with negativity. You know, we're just excited. We want you to be excited too, sort of thing. Kind of like what's going on with the software craftsmanship thing right now. You know, they're excited. They want to share with the world, and a lot of people are pointing fingers at them and, you know, oh, you shouldn't say those things sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think that kind of getting an idea of actually seeing this in person and seeing that it's not about, like, that it really is focused on just writing great software and you know what I mean? Like, I think that it's easy to just kind of read blogs and things and think that it's about putting people down or whatever, picking up on negativity, but it's really just fixed on, it's focused on honing your craft. And so to see, like, this as context is cool.
I mean, it's the same kind of thing that they talk about at you know, the big tech conferences, Tech Ed and PDC and other ones like that. It's there. I mean, sure, Microsoft has the marketing message and they have tools that they want you to use to push their message to stay on, you know, the agenda and whatnot. But, you know, at the same time, they're not building these tools because they hate you and they want you to fail. They think that their approach towards tooling is a way to write better software, whereas
I think
of the other ones disagree. You know, some other people disagree, and we think so. You have to use, you know, other. You have to look towards other communities to pull in there as well, not just stick with a single monolithic vendor. So go ahead.
Yeah,
Andy, sorry.
I was just gonna make a snarky comment and say that, you know, I think at the Alt.NET meetings there's a lot less drag and drop demos. Wow, silence. Ouch. Tough crowd.
Unless the session is about writing drag and drop code. Then it's all drag and drop.
What about jQuery UI draggable?
But what you don't hear is you never hear the phrase without writing a single line of code.
That gets you flogged.
Yeah, we also kind of benefit our local group up in Seattle. We kind of benefit in being so close to the mothership. So, you know, it's real easy for guys like Glenn Block or Paul Batum or Eric Lee to come over and you know, dazzle us with their brilliance. So that's kind of what I think contributes to the local group being kind of enthusiastic and a little less negative. And like was said before, you know, we're not Texans.
Well, it helps to have the Seattle attitude where we're just too cool to be, you know, that big a cheerleader for Microsoft. That's just not, that's not hip. That's not happening. We're not going to, you know, yeah, okay, sure. There's, you know, there's Kurt Cobain. Yeah, whatever. He's all right, I guess. You know, hipsterism was kind of born here, I think, here in the East Village.
I was wondering, is there stuff that you would like, if you were going to make recommendations for other people to do what you did? I mean, we've just talked through a bunch of things. I guess, I don't know, what would you recommend for people trying to do a similar sort of thing? Are there lessons learned or things that you would recommend people not do that you did, or what you would want to try if you were doing this again?
Certain cocktails you should mix, certain drugs you should avoid.
One of the really important things that came out of this was that if you're going to do this, plan a lot, and not from a technical perspective, but have the stories ready. Maybe the thing to do before actually getting a whole bunch of coders together to actually do all this is talk for a couple of days with the product owner and really flush those stories out. Have that all prepped. Because what we saw was while that was starting to happen, there were a lot of people sitting around twiddling their thumbs, and all they wanted to do was write code. And so that's what they did. And unfortunately, that wasn't necessarily what we needed at the time, but that's kind of where we went. So that was a huge lesson learned, is really be prepared from a story perspective and understand what's going on. This was kind of, you know, an experiment, and we've learned some things from it. And the use of tools like the CI server and like Agile Zen and stuff was really great. But at the very, very end, we really, really boiled it down to flip charts and sticky notes, pieces of paper and pencil drawn mock-ups. That went so fast, and they could go around the room. People could see what was going on. That was just very interactive that way. And like I've said before, you can totally get so much done with some sticky notes and a pencil. It's amazing. So,
I guess the thing that I would throw in there is that 12 developers trying to start from no files to a complete project was kind of huge. So if we would have early on stuck with the original idea of having two separate teams working on two separate apps, I think the beginning of the project would have been a little faster. You know, maybe teams of five or even less, possibly focused yeah. on a specific application.
Yeah, smaller teams would have been really good, like five or six people. We kind of saw that. In the future, we actually kind of thought we have a bigger space at the Hill to use, and we thought about using that and maybe some round tables and spread the people apart so they could actually work a little bit more.
I think we should – I mean, like the other big thing I thought was getting people to pair. You know, pair programming made a huge difference. Got people away from staring at their screen, changing the source code tree layout, adding dependencies, and got them talking about the actual problems that we were trying to work on. So
that was me.
That was you that was adding dependencies?
Yeah, and changing the source code tree. And
I'm sorry, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, you did.
Well, if you look at the video that Bobby made, you can see, like, right at the beginning, like, around first there's, like, a few things from Eric, and then there's, like, this explosion. That's Bobby changing the directory of everything.
I think I started it all with, like, a README that was just like, okay, let's put a README in there, and then, okay, we'll see what happens.
Also, in the video, there's somebody, I don't remember who it was, but somebody added a whole ton of references to assemblies and stuff, and it, I mean, because it was like by byte volume or something, it was the largest part of the whole, you know, the whole repository. It looked like they were just like doing all this work, and it was really just it's just a bunch of assemblies.
Right.
I'm gonna have to remember that if the next time I have a manager that tells me I don't check in enough, I'm just gonna add and a bunch of references.
And then just make a video like that and say, like, look at all the work I'm doing.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to, you know, show your geek cred, just, you know, update all your dependencies, check it in, and make a Gorse video.
So everybody was using Visual Studio and obviously GitHub. How much friction was there between, you know, using Git and, because I'm assuming that everyone there was kind of a seasoned Git user. Maybe that's the wrong assumption to make, but at least there would be enough people there to offset the people that didn't know Git very well, and they, you know, they easily ask questions. But what were the biggest friction points with the tools that you chose, given the time frame you were trying to work in?
You know, I think it was kind of funny that I think before we had met up before Friday, I talked to a couple of people, and we were saying, like, oh, maybe we should use Rails, or maybe we should do this or that. And that wasn't our problem at all. And so when we actually got there, it was more kind of like, let's just use the tools that we know, and, you know, that we can just, you know, get some stuff done in, because we're not in a my software is cooler than yours contest. It was, we were actually trying to get stuff done. And everybody there pretty much knew how to use Git. I think at Russell, a lot of people are using Git, and at Milliman, we were using Git. So I don't think that was a big issue. Git has so much penetration. So Razor, that was another thing. I'd never used Razor before, but it was pretty easy. I mean, there weren't really any of those types of technical roadblocks. We just kind of used stuff that we knew, or stuff that enough of us knew, and we didn't really have any problems with it. it was kind of amazing, actually.
Yeah, I think out of the box, Razer was the only thing that none of us had any experience working with. But we'd all worked with Braille and Enhamel and other Vue engines like Spark before. So, you know, once you got the basic syntax down, it was pretty easy to jump in and start using.
I think that actually was the first quote from the event was Chris saying, "And now I'm learning Razer."
Did you find it to be a bit of a letdown? Like when I first started with Razer, I was a letdown in terms of how much you actually had to learn. Like I was thinking, oh, now I have to learn the syntax. And then I started using it. I'm like, oh, okay. It's just kind of simple. Like,
Yeah. That's exactly how I felt. It was kind of like, oh, there's really nothing to this. It's basically, you know, if you know C Sharp, you kind of know Razer.
Right.
Yeah, after using Braille for so long, it was kind of nice actually, you know, oh my god, IntelliSense, I can be lazy again, you know. So that was kind of cool.
So you just described, you know, somebody spending time reorganizing the directory tree. You know, stuff that happens when you've got a 6-month development project, but you might not expect that kind of stuff to happen in a weekend, you know. Did you find that your agile development cycle was just kind of a compressed version of a full development cycle in people, you know, the same kind of things came up or did stuff?
I think that's an interesting question. And yeah, I definitely think that's kind of what happened. I mean, without as much communication as would have happened in, you know, like a 6-month project, but yeah, the same kinds of things happen like that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it was a 6-month project crammed into 48 hours. Where the highs were even higher and the lows were even lower, right? You know, we had the team friction and team gelling and that sort of thing we had to kind of cram into really small periods. So a lot of people kind of, you know, early on kind of paired up with a specific person, like Eric Lee and I paired up quite a bit early on. And I know that Justin and who was it, Aiden? I believe paired up on gathering stories and that sort of thing. And a couple other coworkers from Russell, Mike and Scott kind of paired up and looking at data access strategies and that sort of thing. And those teams kind of stuck together in some form or another throughout the entire weekend, really, with, you know, some minor pair switching and that sort of thing.
You know, also in a 6-month project, reorganizing the layout of the source code tree might have been like an all day thing. But in our project, it took like 5 minutes. It's just did really quick.
Yeah, you just did it really quick.
It really set my OCD off that everybody was putting everything in the root directory of the website. It's organization, bastards. Do it.
One thing I noticed, too, is that like there was a ton of conversation going on in this little space. Just so to give you an idea of the space that we were in, it was pretty much a den, a little bit bigger than a den. You could cram all these people, and they were really sitting like side by side doing all this work. And people needed time every now and again to kind of just chill, and we took breaks and just totally move off, go out and kind of relax, enjoy the scenery. So Harmony Hill is actually in Union, the city, right at the end of the Hood Canal, kind of at the bottom of the Hook. And it's this beautiful place. And so every now and again, people took this opportunity to really enjoy not only the setting we were in and kind of relax, decompress, and come back. And that really kind of helped people gel, I think, and relax. Towards the end, me and Eric Lee were pairing. So that was one of the switches. Towards the end, we were kind of pairing on doing some of the Vue stuff and moving into parts of the application we hadn't worked on before. Which was kind of nice to just kind of say, hey, we need to do something different than what we were doing an hour ago.
Yeah, that's definitely something we haven't hit on so far is just how amazing the Harmony Hill facility and staff are. I mean, it was gorgeous. I mean, I couldn't think of a better place to get together and hack on some code, kind of startup style, and be able to walk out, take a hike, or walk down to the waterfront and just enjoy some really beautiful scenery. And they definitely kept us very well fed. And they wouldn't stop thanking us for being there and helping them out. I mean, the staff there is just really amazing.
Yeah, to this day, they're still very appreciative of it. Anytime they can talk to anyone about it, they love to tell the story. And so we never really did talk about kind of what Harmony Hill does. It's a cancer retreat center. And what that means is they offer retreats for one, and they offer 1 and 3 day retreats for people who have been affected by cancer or who have cancer. So it's not just about the people who actually have cancer, but it's also about the people who may have lost a loved one or are caretakers for those people, or and even nurses, people who work in the healthcare industry who have to deal with all the effects of this illness. And I know that's something Scott Kuhn knows about. Me and him actually first met when we both worked at Fred Hutchinson. So it's kind of this thing that's kind of always been a part of my life, working in the in and around the cancer area. And my wife's actually a cancer survivor, so it's all very special to us. And I just wanted to like really take this opportunity to thank all of my friends, all the people who showed up. Once again, that I have the greatest friends on earth, and it's awesome.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the reasons I wanted to participate, was the kind of the connection to cancer. I lost my mother in my 20s to breast cancer. And so, you know, it's always kind of been a soft spot in my heart to donate to cancer and that sort of thing. So to be able to donate my time to something like Harmony Hill, I was totally on board for that.
I was really impressed with how not just impressed. I was I'm really thankful and appreciative of how accommodating they were. They really bent over backwards to take care of us, and they had great food. Even though a lot of our geek friends are not interested in eating vegetarian food, and that's what they primarily cook, I believe, at Harmony Hill. But they went and accommodated us, and they cooked things that they're not used to cooking, and they went and got all these special ingredients just for us. And all we did was sit around and, you know, do stuff that we do every weekend anyway. So it was really, really nice. And I was really impressed with how accommodating they were.
Now, this is just really, really cool. Like, I'm glad that you guys brought this up, because this is, you know, we all do work that we think is cool, but it doesn't always directly merge in with the things that we care about, you know? And so it's like, I mean, sometimes there's sometimes you're lucky and you are able to connect those, but a lot of the time our work is interesting, but it's not, you know, it doesn't focus on, you know, whatever, like our lives and what we, you know, outside of work. And so I think this is really cool that you guys are, you know, pointing this out. This reminds me a little bit of, there was something a few years ago I remember hearing about. Somebody had something set up where they would do, people would like do work for nonprofits and that kind of thing. And they had something coordinated, and they would give away, was that Give Camps or what was that? It was, and they would like give away prizes, and they would, you know, do something neat because of that. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? Was that Give Camps? I'm seeing
it might have been. That's kind of where I got the idea from.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there are several camps of this type that are kind of around the country. So yeah, it's a common thing, but it's the first time I've ever participated in one, and it's definitely something that I want to do more of in the future. We kind of mentioned all of us being regulars at the local alt.net meetings, but in those meetings we generally do a lot of talking and not a lot of doing. Mm-hmm. And so kind of my focus this last year or so has been to discover ways of doing what we're talking about. You know, so it's not good enough to just talk about, you know, how awesome IOC is and how awesome InHibernate is and this new cool Fluent interface sort of thing. But let's actually get together and build stuff with it. And if we can get together and build stuff for a good cause, then all the better.
Looking back, were there any technological decisions that you made that you would do differently, or that you have done differently after the initial get together?
I personally don't think so. For me, Bobby, I might have a different opinion, but from what I saw, I wouldn't have necessarily made too many different changes.
Yeah, I think we kind of fell down on our practices a little bit in the mad scramble to get something going. If you actually go run code coverage numbers on Dahlia, I think it's at something like 30%. And I think a lot of that has to do with just a compressed time frame and desperation. So, you know, the first thing to go is, oh, I'm not going to write a test. I'm just going to hack out this code real fast and make it work, sort of thing. I personally would have preferred focusing on a kind of a test first approach and making sure things work the way we think they do. One of the problems that came up during the course of the weekend was we started out with a repository that was just an in-memory collection, right? So you basically have your CRUD operations and query operations against a list of that object type or whatever. And then once we got in Hibernate all wired up and we went to switch the repository over to using in Hibernate, we actually forgot to switch the read methods. So the repositories were saving to the database, but it never actually read from the database. But because the collection was kept in memory while the application was running, it looked like it worked. It was really weird. You would save something and then you'd refresh the page and it wouldn't be there, but you'd go query the database and it was there. So we stumbled over little things like that because of the time constraints. So maybe,
ashamed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally forgot about that. That did suck.
It was really amusing once we realized what was going on.
I remember that flash of brilliance when someone was like, oh, wait, they're in memory.
Wasn't there a people joked about that there was a write-only database extension for MySQL and that it had infinite scale? You know, because it was like, you know, NoSQL is nothing. We've got no back end.
Yeah, our Dahlia application is web scale.
There you go.
And then obviously not making the deadline, right? We didn't end the weekend with a completed app, but I think we're all committed to getting it completed. It's now just figuring out how to do that online and do that open source kind of project management thing.
Yeah, I think like really technology, other than the write-only database thing, I don't think technology got in our way at all. It was really all people things that got in our way and just us learning how to work as a group, I think.
Well, it's usually that way, right? It's not the technology that gets in your way. It's interactions with the team and the product owner and getting all that kind of lined out and streamlined.
Yep. Needs more Cylons. That's the problem. Yeah, that definitely people were probably the biggest issue as far as that. But it all worked out in the end. So.
Well, you had to know you weren't going to finish over the weekend because there's an old adage that to a developer, a weekend is an infinite amount of time. So if you ask them on Friday, you know, or Wednesday, how long is it going to take you to, you know, to finish that feature? They'll always say, oh, I'll work on it on the weekend. It'll be done by Monday. And then, you know, it doesn't matter what the actual feature is or how many features there are or how big the task is. You can always get it done in a weekend.
I disagree. I think we could have done it. Those one things would have went right, you know, we could have.
But one more day. One more day would have totally done it.
For some definition of it.
Well, you should have slept less. That's one thing.
Actually, if you look at some of the commit times, there are people up committing at like 3 a.m. And people were up at like 5 in the morning. I mean, just so jazzed to be like doing this that they would sleep maybe just a couple hours.
Wow.
And then be back up doing stuff.
You remember that scene in Hackers where they're like trying to get into the mainframe and there's like two people there working and then someone comes in and takes over a spot? It was totally like that.
Having it next to a 3-day weekend. So like we could all not sleep Friday, Saturday and you know, drive home Sunday night and we, you know, have a day to recover. If that would have been a work day the next day, it would have been a lot tougher.
Yeah, we did do it over the President's Day weekend so that people would have that extra day. So that helped a lot, I think.
So anything else you guys want to talk about in general?
I can barely remember what we talked about.
Eric mentioned the open source track at Alt.net Seattle. I don't know that much about it, but I think it sounds really cool. I know a little bit about what we had talked about when we started planning. The idea was, I think, to have people bring in open source projects that they're working on. And I don't remember what projects they're going to actually bring in. I think Sebastian Lamla is coming, maybe, or I don't know. I don't know if you know any more about that, Eric, but I think that's kind of a interesting thing. And that's a chance for people to come and look at Dahlia and maybe get more people to participate in it.
Yeah, I don't know about the other projects, but I do know that my wife will also be there. So again, the product owner will actually be on site. And that's been a huge thing for us, really, to actually have an active product owner for an open source product. It's kind of completely different than all these products we normally build for the community. You know, we all build stuff for ourselves. And Dahlia is a project not for us, but built by the community, and have an active product owner who's willing to show up and kind of, you know, play with it and punch the buttons and tell you everything's working exactly the way she wants it.
All righty. John, Kevin, you have anything else?
I was just going to point out that I've spent this entire time on Herding Code pantsless. Just think about that mental image.
You know, I edit that out. I've got a plug-in, so don't worry.
Do you have a plug-in that will edit it out of my brain?
up with is it. Is this the part they play after the end song?
If you'd like.
We all say silly things.
Yeah, I think this is that part where Bobby tells us all he's not wearing any pants.
Should we talk about the cowboy hat of shame?
We should talk about the cowboy hat of shame.
We have a cowboy hat of shame.
A pink cowboy hat of shame with a tiara.
Yeah, if you're programming alone without a pair, you're supposed to put on the hat, raise your hand, and shout out, "I'm coding alone!" And
no, what's shameful about a pink cowboy hat with a tiara? I have one here.
Oh, well, do you code alone a lot? Actually, Agile Open Northwest is where we got that idea from, so props to whoever it was who mentioned it to us.
Do you guys still have those wizard hats?
No, they don't have them around that I know of, but there's a hat shop right by the office and in the market, so that's kind of where we went to like get funny hats.
Oh, okay.
Is that the one with all the pimp suits in the window, or is that next to the one with the pimp suits in the window?
I believe that's the one, sir.
Yeah, I think it is. It's right by the tea place in the market.
Yeah.
That's where we went. We were looking for the big giant foam hat, but we couldn't find one, so we thought that the pink tiara cowboy hat would be just as good.
So this is the Pimp Your Stuff portion of the podcast. You guys have any upcoming speaking engagements, books, or other podcasts that you're going to be on so that we can cut you out of this one?
Well, to write a book, we'd all have to know how to write.
Not necessarily.
Yeah. Just one of us.
Yeah. I just did a user group meetup for continuous integration in the real world, but that's about it. I mean, we're basically just a group of average Joe developers. I don't think any of us that went are MVPs other than the actual Microsoft employees that showed up, right? So... Yeah, we're just guys that like to program and like to do that together sort of thing. I think all of us at least have open source projects we could discuss, maybe.
We already talked about mine, so for now.
Well, yeah, you were going to talk a little bit more about Harmony Hill?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Harmony Hill is, well, I kind of covered that, but Harmony Hill is a great place to contribute your dollars. They definitely need it. Some statistics. They have the same staff. Right now that they used in 2001 to serve 70 some participants, and last year with that same level of staffing they serviced 1100 participants, so you can tell that the people work very, very, very hard, very long hours. So any dollars that you have to contribute or your time is certainly valuable to them, especially organizations that match any time donated by their employees. That always helps. And this year's their 25th anniversary, so they've been around for quite some time. It's a beautiful place to go check out. You can rent the facilities. That helps. That's how they cover their costs. So the facilities are available for private rentals, weddings, a weekend getaway, outings for your corporation, any of those kind of things that you want to do. They're all available. Check out the site, harmonyhill.org. Just got redone. And, check it out. Read. It's awesome.
Chris, do you have anything coming up?
Nope. Just raising kids.
So stop hiding behind your children, Bilson.
Well, we'll have the Alt.net conference in May. This year, we were going to try and charge for it because we wanted to bring more people in, but now it's free. I think there might still be some spaces available. That's my favorite event of the year, so I hope people go to that. That's
last slot went today. Justin tweeted about it, and it was gone within like 20 minutes.
Sigh. Oh, well. So much for that.
You snooze, you lose, folks. Okay, wrap it up. Yes?
Yeah. I mean, so there no other open source projects or anything you guys want to pimp? Or I guess we could.
Check out Giles, coworker Jeff Schumacher's auto testing framework. Very hot.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and I've been doing a lot of work with Simple Data recently, which is a really awesome lightweight ORM based on the new dynamic stuff added with C# 4.
Yep. Yeah, we had Mark Rendell on the
show. We should get that guy on. Oh, wait. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, really cool framework. I've been kind of hack in on building a SQLite implementation or providers for SQLite. So I'm getting in kind of deep into the bowels of that system, and it's amazing how elegant the source code is.
Hey, Scott, when do we get to see your MVC generator thing that's just going to make my life not suck?
Soon. So I'm still vacillating between using NuGet versus OpenWrap. So the big reason that I might not use NuGet is that it doesn't allow you to modify the project files through the command line yet, and that's kind of a big deal for adding references to when you're creating new projects.
So you mean modifying like CS proj files?
Yeah.
You can use PowerShell. I assume you're talking about using PowerShell.
Well, talking about using if I use something like a Chewy with maybe NuGet or something else.
Okay. Yeah. Well, because with PowerShell, it's really easy to manipulate XML files, and CS proj file is so.
It's more the fact that you got to get the what's it called, the GUID thing for it, and make sure that reference is in there and all that when you have the references. And ideally, it'd be nicer if there was a library function in NuGet let me add reference to project.
Or more of Visual Studio is kind of automatable that way. I wish they would do that. Mm-hmm.
And I think OpenWrap, if I remember correctly, does something like that. So it'll actually go through and add the dependency in. And when you do a new pull via OpenWrap, it will pull down the latest versions of things that you have dependencies on and modify the project file appropriately. I think. I'll have to check on that.
I think
that's the one thing.
I don't know about the overlap, but I know that Eric Hextra has that Solution Factory, and he was using NuGet with Solution Factory together. Solution Factory being a way to like automate and do things outside of what NuGet does as well.
You may have to look at that too. Yeah. So the last kind of part to that is getting an MVC binary NuGet package up there, which may or may not happen, because otherwise I have to bundle the MVC binaries with the project. So that means that every time that MVC updates, I have to update my project. and you have to download and use a new version of the command line generator, which is kind of a pain.
So you have to update it like every 2 years.
Don't use MVC. I mean, go with something awesome like Nancy.
that's coming. that's the big thing. The idea was to make a Rails-like command line generator for controllers, views, even being able to pull in models. So maybe V2 will have the ability to specify in Hibernate or EF and pull in those dependencies and then generate models based off of templates for those things. Maybe not. Maybe using something like Simple Data would be an easier target to hit, but I don't know. It's up there. Feel free to fork and pull and make changes. There's even tests for some reason.
Yeah, kind of the reason I've taken an interest in Simple Data recently is I really love how clean Rails migrations are. And I kind of want to get to the point that I can use something like Fluent Migrator to push a database schema into a database and not have to write even models, right? I just got an ORM that dynamically creates types for me. Based on the schema of the database that was created a millisecond before it queried the database, sort of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my goal with hacking on Simple Data is to get SQLite support in there to where I can generate a database from migrations and then do in-memory unit tests based on that. Not sure where I was going with that, but Simple Data, Simple Data, Simple Data.
Alrighty. Well, that's it for this edition of Herding Code. Tune in next time when we hear John say...
Developers, 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 developers.